Tony said. Stand straight and don't slump. He said it calmly, quietly, in a matter-of-fact voice, not moving at all. Then there was silence. Just faint background noises booming elsewhere in the building and thumping in Stone's chest. His eyes were adjusting to the gloom. He could see the score marks on the desktop from Hobie's hook. They made an angry tracery deep in the wood. The silence was unsettling him. He had absolutely no idea how to react to this. He glanced at the sofa to his left. It was humiliating to stand. Doubly so when told to by a damn receptionist. He glanced at the sofa to his right. He knew he should fight back. He should just go ahead and sit down on one of the sofas. Just step left or right and sit down. Ignore the guy. Just do it. Just sit down and show the guy who was boss. Like hitting a winning return or trumping an ace. Sit down, for God's sake, he told himself. But his legs would not move. It was like he was paralyzed. He stood still, a yard in front of the desk, rigid with outrage and humiliation. And fear. You're wearing Mr. Hobie's jacket, Tony said. Would you take it off, please? Stone stared at him. Then he glanced down at his jacket. It was his Savile Row. He realized that for the first time in his life, he'd accidentally worn the same thing 2 days running. This is my jacket, he said. No, it's Mr. Hobie's. Stone shook his head. I bought it in London. It's definitely my jacket. Tony smiled in the dark. You don't understand, do you? He said. Understand what? Stone said blankly. That Mr. Hobie owns you now. You're his. And everything you have is his. Stone stared at him. There was silence in the room. Just the faint background noises from the building and the thumping in Stone's chest. So take Mr. Hobie's jacket off, Tony said quietly. Stone was just staring at him, his mouth opening and closing, no sound coming out of it. Take it off, Tony said. It's not your property. You shouldn't be standing there wearing another man's jacket. His voice was quiet, but there was menace in it. Stone's face was rigid with shock, but then suddenly his arms were starting to move, like they were outside of his conscious control. He struggled off with the jacket and held it out by the collar, like he was in the menswear department, handing back a garment he'd tried and hadn't liked. On the desk, please, Tony said. Stone laid the jacket flat on the desk. He straightened it and felt the fine wool snagging over the rough surface. Tony pulled it closer and went into the pockets, one after the other. He assembled the contents in a small pile in front of him. Balled up the jacket and tossed it casually over the desk onto the left-hand sofa. He picked up the Mont Blanc fountain pen, made an appreciative little shape with his mouth, and slipped it into his own pocket. Then he picked up the bunch of keys, fanned them on the desktop and picked through them one at a time, selected the car key, and held it up between his finger and thumb. Mercedes! Stone nodded blankly. Model? 500 SEL, Stone muttered. New? Stone shrugged. A year old? Color? Dark blue? Where? At my office, Stone muttered. In the lot. We'll pick it up later, Tony said. He opened a drawer and dropped the keys into it, pushed the drawer shut, and turned his attention to the wallet. He held it upside down and shook it and raked the contents out with his finger. When it was empty, he tossed it under the desk. Stone heard it clang into a trash can. Tony glanced once at the picture of Marilyn and pitched it after the wallet. Stone heard a fainter clang as the stiff photographic paper hit the metal. Tony stacked the credit cards with three fingers and slid them to one side like a croupier. Guy we know will give us $100 for these, he said. Then he riffed the paper money together and sorted it by denomination, counted it up, and clipped it together with a paperclip, dropped it into the same drawer as the keys. "What do you guys want?" Stone asked. Tony looked up at him. "I want you to take Mr. Hobie's tie off," he said. Stone shrugged helplessly. "No, seriously, what do you guys want from me?"
$17.1 million, that's what you owe us."
Stone nodded. "I know, I'll pay you."
"When?" Tony asked.
"Well, I need a little time," Stone said.
Tony nodded. "Okay, you've got an hour."
Stone stared at him. "No, I need more than an hour."
"An hour is all you've got."
"I can't do it in an hour."
"I know you can't," Tony said. "You can't do it in an hour, or a day, or a week, or a month, or a year. Because you're a useless piece of shit who couldn't manage his way out of a wet grocery sack, aren't you?"
"What?"
"You're a disgrace, Stone. You took a business your grandfather slaved over and your father built bigger, and you flushed it all straight down the toilet because you're totally stupid, aren't you?"
Stone shrugged blankly. Then he swallowed. "Okay, so I took some hits," he said. "But what could I do?"
"Take the tie off!"
Tony screamed at him.
Stone jumped and flung his hands up, struggled with the knot. "Get it off, you piece of shit!" Tony screamed.
He tore it off, dropped it on the desk. It lay there in a tangle.
"Thank you, Mr. Stone," Tony said quietly.
"What do you guys want?" Stone whispered.
Tony opened a different drawer and came out with a handwritten sheet of paper. It was yellow and filled with a dense, untidy scrawl. Some kind of a list with figures totaled at the bottom of the page. "We own 39% of your corporation," he said. "As of this morning, what we want is another 12%. Stone stared at him, did the math in his head.
"A controlling interest?"
"Exactly," Tony said. "We hold 39%, another 12 gives us 51, which would indeed represent a controlling interest."
Stone swallowed again and shook his head. "No," he said. "No, I won't do that."
"Okay. Then we want $17.1 million within the hour."
Stone just stood there, glancing wildly left and right. The door opened behind him, and the thick-set man in the expensive suit came in and padded soundlessly across the carpet and stood with his arms folded behind Tony's left shoulder.
"The watch, please," Tony said.
Stone glanced at his left wrist. It was a Rolex. It looked like steel, but it was platinum. He had bought it in Geneva. He unlatched it and handed it over. Tony nodded and dropped it in another drawer.
"Now take Mr. Hobie's shirt off."
"You can't make me give you more stock," Stone said.
"I think we can. Take the shirt off, okay?"
"Look, I won't be intimidated," Stone said, as confidently as he could.
"You're already intimidated," Tony said back, "aren't you? You're about to make a mess in Mr. Hobie's pants. Which would be a bad mistake, by the way, because we'd only make you clean them up."
Stone said nothing, just stared at a spot in the air between the two men.
12% of the equity, Tony said gently. "Why not? It's not worth anything. And you'd still have 49% left."
"I need to speak with my lawyers," Stone said.
"Okay, go ahead."
Stone looked around the room desperately. "Where's the phone?"
"There's no phone in here," Tony said. "Mr. Hobie doesn't like phones."
"So how?"
"Shout," Tony said. "Shout real loud and maybe your lawyers will hear you."
"What?"
"Shout," Tony said again. "You're real slow, aren't you, Mr. Stone? Put two and two together and draw a conclusion. There's no phone in here. You can't leave the room. You want to talk with your lawyers, so you'll have to shout."
Stone stared blankly into space.
"Shout, you useless piece of shit!"
Tony screamed at him. "No, I can't,"
Stone said helplessly. I don't know what you mean.
Take the shirt off, Tony screamed.
Stone shook violently, hesitated with his arms halfway in the air.
Get it off, you piece of shit,
Tony screamed again. Stone's hand leapt up and unbuttoned it all the way down. He tore it off and stood there holding it, shaking in his undershirt.
Fold it neatly, please, Tony said. Mr. Hobie likes his things neat.
Stone did his best. He shook it out by the collar and folded it in half, and half again. He bent and laid it square on top of the jacket on the sofa.
Give up the 12%, Tony said.
No, Stone said back, clenching his hands. There was silence, silence and darkness.
Efficiency, Tony said quietly. That's what we like here.
You should have paid more attention to efficiency, Mr. Stone. Then maybe your business wouldn't be in the toilet. So what's the most efficient way for us to do this? Stone shrugged helplessly.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Then I'll explain, Tony said. We want you to comply. We want your signature on a piece of paper. So how do we get that?
You'll never get it, you bastard, Stone said. I'll go bankrupt first, damn it. Chapter 11, you won't get a damn thing from me. Not a thing. You'll be in court 5 years minimum.
Tony shook his head patiently, like a grade school teacher hearing the wrong answer for the 100th time in a long career.
Do whatever you want, Stone said to him. I won't give you my company.
We could hurt you, Tony said.
Stone's eyes dropped through the gloom to the desktop. His tie was still lying there right on top of the rough gouges from the hook.
Take Mr. Hobie's pants off, Tony screamed.
No, I won't, damn it,
Stone screamed back.
The guy at Tony's shoulder reached under his arm. There was a squeak of leather. Stone stared at him incredulous. The guy came out with a small black handgun. He used one arm and aimed it eye level straight out. He advanced around the desk toward Stone, nearer and nearer. Stone's eyes were wide and staring, fixed on the gun. It was aimed at his face. He was shaking and sweating. The guy was stepping quietly and the gun was coming closer and Stone's eyes were crossing, following it in. The gun came to rest with the muzzle on his forehead. The guy was pressing with it. The muzzle was hard and cold. Stone was shaking, leaning backward against the pressure, stumbling, trying to focus on the black blur that was the gun. He never saw the guy's other hand balling into a fist, never saw the blow swinging in. It smashed hard into his gut and he went down like a sack, legs folding, squirming and gasping and retching.
Take the pants off, you piece of shit! Tony screamed down at him.
The other guy landed a savage kick, and Stone yelped and rolled around and around on his back like a turtle, gasping, gagging, wrenching at his belt. He got it loose, scrabbled for the buttons and the zip. He tore the pants down over his legs. They snagged on his shoes, and he wrenched them free and pulled them off inside out.
Get up, Mr. Stone, Tony said quietly.
Stone staggered to his feet and stood unsteadily, leaning forward, head down, panting, his hands on his knees, his stomach heaving, thin, white, hairless legs coming down out of his boxers, ludicrous dark socks and shoes on his feet.
We could hurt you, Tony said. You understand that now, right?
Stone nodded and gasped. He was pressing both forearms into his gut, heaving and gagging.
You understand that, right? Tony asked again.
Stone forced another nod.
Say the words, Mr. Stone, Tony said. Say we could hurt you.
You could hurt me,
Stone gasped.
But we won't. That's not how Mr. Hobie likes things to be done.
Stone raised a hand and swiped tears from his eyes and looked up, hopefully.
Mr. Hobie prefers to hurt the wives, Tony said.
Efficiency, you see? It gets faster results.
So at this point, you really need to be thinking about Marilyn.
The rented Taurus was much faster than the Bravada had been. On dry June roads, there was no contest. Maybe in the snows of January or the sleet of February, he would have appreciated the full-time four-wheel drive. But for a fast trip up the Hudson in June, a regular sedan had it all over a Jeep, that was for damn sure. It was low and stable. It rode well. It tracked through the bends like an automobile should. And it was quiet. He had his radio locked onto a powerful city station behind him, and a woman called Winona Judd was asking him, "Why not me?" He felt he shouldn't be liking Winona Judd as much as he was, because if somebody had asked him if he'd enjoyed a country vocalist singing plaintively about love, he'd have probably said no, he wouldn't, based on his preconceptions. But she had a hell of a voice, and the number had a hell of a guitar part, and the lyric was getting to him, because he was imagining it was Jody singing to him, not Winona Judd. She was singing, "Why not me when you're growing old? Why not me?" He started singing along with it, his rough bass rumble underneath the soaring contralto, and by the time the number faded and the commercial started, he was figuring if he ever had a house and a stereo like other people did, he'd buy the record. Why not me? He was heading north on Route 9, and he had a Hertz map open beside him which went up far enough to show him Brighton was halfway between Peekskill and Poughkeepsie, over to the west, right on the Hudson. He had the old couple's address beside it, written on a sheet from a medical pad from McBannerman's office. He had the Taurus moving at a steady 65, fast enough to get him there, slow enough to get him there unmolested by the traffic cops, who he assumed were hiding out around every wooded corner, waiting to boost their municipal revenues with their radar guns and their books of blank tickets. It took him an hour to get level with Garrison again, and he figured he would head on north to a big highway he remembered swinging away west over the river toward Newburgh. He should be able to come off that road just short of the Hudson and fall on Brighton from above. Then it was just a question of hunting down the address, which might not be easy. But it was easy, because the road that dropped him south into Brighton from the east-west highway was labeled with the same name as was in the second line of the old folks' address. He cruised south, watching for mailboxes and house numbers. Then it started to get harder. The mailboxes were grouped in sixes, clustered hundreds of yards apart, standing on their own with no obvious connection to any particular houses. In fact, there were very few houses visible at all. It seemed like they were all up little rural tracks, gravel and patch blacktop, running off left and right into the woods like tunnels. He found the right mailbox. It was set on a wooden post that the weather was rotting and the frost heave was canting forward. Vigorous green vines and thorny creepers were twisting up around it. It was a large-sized box, dull green, with the house number painted on the side in faded but immaculate freehand script. The door was hanging open because the box was completely stuffed with mail. He took it all out and squared it on the passenger seat beside him. Squeaked the door closed and saw a name painted on the front in the same faded, neat hand. Hobie. The mailboxes were all on the right side of the road for the convenience of the mail carrier, but the tracks ran off in both directions. There were four of them visible from where he was stopped, two of them to the left and two to the right. He shrugged and headed down the first of them, leading to the right over toward the river. It was the wrong track. There were two houses down there, one north and one south. One of them had a duplicate nameplate on the gates, Kaczynski. The other had a bright red Pontiac Firebird parked under a new basketball hoop on the garage gable. Children's bicycles were sprawled on a lawn, not persuasive evidence of aged and infirm people living there. The first track on the left was wrong, too. He found the right place on the second right-hand track. There was an overgrown driveway running away south, parallel with the river. There was an old, rusted mailbox at the gate, back from when the postal service was prepared to come a little nearer to your house. Same dull green color, but even more faded. Same neat painted script, faded like a ghost. Hobie. There were power lines and a phone cable running in, swarming with vines which hung down like curtains. He swung the Taurus into the driveway, brushing vegetation on both sides, and came to a stop behind an old Chevy sedan, parked at an angle under a carport. The old car was a full-size, hood and trunk like flight decks, turning the same pitted dull brown that all old cars turn. He killed the motor and got out in the silence. Ducked back in and grabbed the stack of mail and stood there holding it. The house was a low one-story, running away from him to the west toward the river. The house was the same brown as the car, ancient boards and shingles. The yard was a riot. It was what a tended garden becomes in 15 untouched years of wet springs and hot summers. There had been a wide path running around from the carport to the front door, but it was narrowed like a gangplank with encroaching brush. He looked around and figured an infantry platoon equipped with flamethrowers would be more use there than gardeners. He made it to the door, with the brush grabbing and snatching at his ankles. There was a bell push, but it was rusted solid. He leaned forward and rapped on the wood with his knuckles. Then he waited. No response. He rapped again. He could hear the jungle seething behind him, insect noise. He could hear the muffler ticking as it cooled underneath the Taurus over on the driveway. He knocked again. Waited. There was the creak of floorboards inside the house. The sound was carrying ahead of somebody's footsteps and spilling out to him. The footsteps halted on the other side of the door, and he heard a woman's voice, thin and muffled by the wood. "Who's there?" it called out. "Reacher," he called back. "General Garber's friend." His voice was loud. Behind him, he heard panic scurrying in the brush. Furtive animals were fleeing. In front of him, he heard a stiff lock turning and bolts easing back. The door creaked open, darkness inside. He stepped forward into the shadow of the eaves and saw an old woman waiting. She was maybe 80, stick-thin, white hair, stooped, wearing a faded floral print dress that flared right out from the waist over nylon petticoats. It was the sort of dress he'd seen in photographs of women at suburban garden parties in the 50s and the 60s. The sort of dress that was normally worn with long white gloves and a wide-brimmed hat and a contented bourgeois smile.
"We're expecting you," she said.
She turned and stood aside. He nodded and went in. The radius of the skirt meant he had to push past its flare with a loud rustle of nylon.
"I brought your mail," he said to her. "Your box was full."
He held up the thick stack of curled envelopes and waited.
"Thank you," she said. "You're very kind. It's a long walk out there, and we don't like to stop the car to get it in case we get rear-ended. It's a very busy road. People drive terribly fast, you know, faster than they should, I think."
Reacher nodded. It was about the quietest road he had ever seen. A person could sleep the night out there, right on the yellow line, with a good chance of surviving until morning. He was still holding the mail. The old lady showed no curiosity over it. "Where would you like me to put it?"
"Would you put it in the kitchen?"
The hallway was a dark space paneled in gloomy wood. The kitchen was worse. It had a tiny window, glassed in with yellow reeded glass. There was a collection of freestanding units in muddy dark veneer, and curious old enamel appliances speckled in mint greens and grays standing up on short legs. The whole room smelled of old food and a warm oven, but it was clean and tidy. A rag rug on worn linoleum. There was a chipped china mug with a pair of thick eyeglasses standing vertically in it. He put the stack of mail next to the mug. When her visitor was gone, she would use her eyeglasses to read her mail. Right after, she put her best frock back in the closet with the mothballs.
"May I offer you cake?" she asked.
He glanced at the stovetop. There was a china plate there covered over with a worn linen cloth. She'd baked something for him.
"And coffee?"
Next to the stovetop was an ancient percolator, mint green enamel, green glass knob on the top, connected to the outlet by a cord insulated with frayed fabric. He nodded.
"I love coffee and cake," he said.
She nodded back, pleased, bustled forward, crushing her skirt against the oven door. She used a thin, trembling thumb and operated the switch on the percolator. It was already filled and ready to go.
"It takes a moment," she said.
Then she paused and listened. The old percolator started a loud gulping sound.
"So come and meet Mr. Hobie. He's awake now and very anxious to see you while we're waiting for the machine."
She led him through the hallway to a small parlor in back. It was about 12 by 12, and heavily furnished with armchairs and sofas, and glass-fronted chest-high cabinets filled with china ornaments. There was an old guy in one of the chairs. He was wearing a stiff serge suit, blue, worn and shiny in places, and at least three sizes too big for his shrunken body. The collar of his shirt was a wide, stiff hoop around a pale, scrawny neck. Random silky tufts of white were all that was left of his hair. His wrists were like pencils protruding from the cuffs of his suit. His hands were thin and bony, laid loosely on the arms of the chair. He had clear plastic tubes looped over his ears, running down under his nose. There was a bottle of oxygen on a wheeled cart parked behind him. He looked up and took a long, loud sniff of the gas to fuel the effort of lifting his hand.
"Major Reacher," he said, "I'm very pleased to meet you."
Reacher stepped forward and grasped the hand and shook it. It was cold and dry, and it felt like a skeleton's hand wrapped in flannel. The old guy paused and sucked more oxygen and spoke again.
"I'm Tom Hobie, Major, and this lovely lady is my wife, Mary."
Reacher nodded. "Pleased to meet you both," he said, "but I'm not a major anymore." The old guy nodded back and sucked the gas through his nose.
"You served," he said. "Therefore, I think you're entitled to your rank."
There was a field stone fireplace built low in the center of one wall. The mantel was packed tight with photographs in ornate silver frames. Most of them were color snaps showing the same subject, a young man in olive fatigues, in a variety of poses and situations. There was one older picture among them, airbrushed black and white, a different man in uniform, tall and straight and smiling, a private first class from a different generation of service. Possibly Mr. Hobie himself, before his failing heart started killing him from the inside, although it was hard for Reacher to tell. There was no resemblance.
"That's me,"
Hobie confirmed, following his gaze. "World War II?" Reacher asked. The old man nodded, sadness in his eyes.
"I never went overseas," he said. "I volunteered well ahead of the draft, but I had a weak heart, even back then. They wouldn't let me go, so I did my time in a storeroom in New Jersey."
Reacher nodded. Hobie had his arm behind him, fiddling with the cylinder valve, increasing the oxygen flow.
"I'll bring the coffee now," the old lady said, "and the cake."
"Can I help you with anything?" Reacher asked her.
"No, I'll be fine," she said,
and swished slowly out of the room.
"Sit down, Major, please,"
Tom Hobie said. Reacher nodded and sat down in the silence, in a small armchair near enough to catch the old guy's fading voice. He could hear the rattle of his breathing. Nothing else, just a faint hiss from the top of the oxygen bottle and the clink of china from the kitchen. Patient domestic sounds. The window had a Venetian blind, lime-green plastic, tilted down against the light. The river was out there somewhere, presumably beyond an overgrown yard, maybe 30 miles upstream of Leon Garber's place.
"Here we are,"
Mrs. Hobie called from the hallway. She was on her way back into the room with a wheeled cart. There was a matching china set stacked on it, cups and saucers and plates, with a small milk jug and a sugar bowl. The linen cover was off the platter, revealing a pound cake, drizzled with some kind of yellow icing, maybe lemon. The old percolator was there, smelling of coffee.
"How do you like it?"
"No milk, no sugar," Reacher said. She poured coffee into a cup, her thin wrist quivering with the effort. The cup rattled in its saucer as she passed it across. She followed it with a quarter of the cake on a plate. The plate shook. The oxygen bottle hissed. The old man was rehearsing his story, dividing it up into bites, taking in enough oxygen to fuel each one of them.
"I was a printer,"
he said suddenly.
"I ran my own shop. Mary worked for a big customer of mine. We met and were married in the spring of 47. Our son was born in the June of 48.
He turned away and ran his glance along the line of photographs.
"Our son, Victor Truman Hobie,"
The parlor fell quiet like an observance.
I believed in duty,
the old man said.
I was unfit for active service, and I regretted it. Regretted it bitterly, Major. But I was happy to serve my country any way I could, and I did. We brought our son up the same way, to love his country and to serve it. He volunteered for Vietnam.
Old Mr. Hobie closed his mouth and sucked oxygen through his nose once, twice, and then he leaned down to the floor beside him and came up with a leather-bound folder. He spread it across his bony legs and opened it up, took out a photograph and passed it across. Reacher juggled his cup and his plate and leaned forward to take it from the shaking hand. It was a faded color print of a boy in a backyard. The boy was maybe 9 or 10, stocky, toothy, freckled, grinning, wearing a metal bowl upside down on his head, with a toy rifle shouldered, his stiff denim trousers tucked into his socks to resemble the look of fatigues buckled into gaiters.
He wanted to be a soldier,
Mr. Hobie said.
Always. It was his ambition. I approved of it at the time, of course. We were unable to have other children, so Victor was on his own. The light of our lives. And I thought that to be a soldier and to serve his country was a fine ambition for the only son of a patriotic father.
There was silence again. A cough. A hiss of oxygen. Silence.
Did you approve of Vietnam, Major?
Hobie asked suddenly. Reacher shrugged.
I was too young to have much of an opinion, he said. But knowing what I know now, no, I wouldn't have approved of Vietnam.
Why not?
Wrong place, Reacher said. Wrong time, wrong reasons, wrong methods, wrong approach, wrong leadership. No real backing, no real will to win, no coherent strategy.
Would you have gone?
Reacher nodded. Yes, I would have gone, he said. No choice. I was a son of a soldier, too. But I would have been jealous of my father's generation. Much easier to go to World War II.
Victor wanted to fly helicopters,
Hobie said.
He was passionate about it. My fault again, I'm afraid. I took him to a county fair. Paid $2 for him to have his first flight in one. It was an old Bell, a crop duster. After that, all he wanted to be was a helicopter pilot. And he decided the Army was the best place to learn how.
He slid another photograph out of the folder, passed it across. It showed the same boy, now twice the age, grown tall, still grinning, in new fatigues, standing in front of an Army helicopter. It was an H-23 Hiller, an old training machine.
That's Fort Walters,
Hobie said.
All the way down in Texas. U.S. Army Primary Helicopter School.
Reacher nodded. He flew choppers in Nam?
He passed out second in his class,
Hobie said.
That was no surprise to us. He was always an excellent student all the way through high school. He was especially gifted in math. He understood accountancy. I imagined he'd go to college and then come into a partnership with me to do the book work. I looked forward to it. I struggled in school, Major. No reason to be coy about it now. I'm not an educated man. It was a constant delight for me to see Victor doing so well. He was a very smart boy, and a very good boy, very smart, very kind, a good heart, a perfect son, our only son.
The old lady was silent, not eating the cake, not drinking the coffee.
His passing out was at Fort Rucker,
Hobie said.
Down in Alabama, we made the trip to see it.
He slid across the next photograph. It was a duplicate of one of the framed prints from the mantel. Faded pastel grass and sky, a tall boy in dress uniform, cap down over his eyes, his arm around an older woman in a print dress. The woman was slim and pretty. The photograph was slightly out of focus, the horizon slightly tilted, taken by a fumbling husband and father, breathless with pride.
That's Victor and Mary,
the old man said.
She hasn't changed a bit, has she? That day to this.
Not a bit, Reacher lied.
We love that boy,
the old woman said quietly.
He was sent overseas 2 weeks after that photograph was taken.
July of 68, Hobie said. He was 20 years old.
What happened? Reacher asked.
He served a full tour, Hobie said. He was commended twice. He came home with a medal. I could see right away the idea of keeping the books for a print shop was too small for him. I thought he would serve out his time and get a job flying helicopters for the oil rigs down in the Gulf, perhaps. They were paying big money then for Army pilots, or Navy or Air Force, of course.
But he went over there again, Mrs. Hobie said. To Vietnam again.
He signed on for a second tour, Mr. Hobie said. He didn't have to, but he said it was his duty. He said the war was still going on and it was his duty to be a part of it. He said that's what patriotism meant.
And what happened? Reacher asked. There was a long moment of silence.
He didn't come back, Hobie said.
The silence was like a weight in the room. Somewhere a clock was ticking. It grew louder and louder until it was filling the air like blows from a hammer.
It destroyed me,
Hobie said quietly. The oxygen wheezed in and out, through a constricted throat.
It just destroyed me. I used to say, I'll exchange the whole rest of my life just for one more day with him.
The rest of my life,
his wife echoed.
For just one more day with him.
And I meant it, Hobie said. And I still would. I still would, Major. Looking at me now, that's not much of a bargain, is it? I haven't got much life left in me. But I said it then, and I said it every day for 30 years. And as God is my witness, I meant it every single time I said it, the whole rest of my life, for one more day with him.
When was he killed? Reacher asked gently.
He wasn't killed, Hobie said. He was captured.
Taken prisoner. The old man nodded.
At first they told us he was missing. We assumed he was dead, but we clung on, hoping. He was posted missing, and he stayed missing. We never got official word he was killed.
So we waited, Mrs. Hobie said. We just kept on waiting for years and years. Then we started asking. They told us Victor was missing, presumed killed. That was all they could say. His helicopter was shot down in the jungle, and they never found the wreckage.
We accepted that then, Hobie said. We knew how it was. Plenty of boys died without a known grave. Plenty of boys always have in war.
Then the memorial went up, Mrs. Hobie said. Have you seen it?
The wall? Reacher said. In D.C.? Yes, I've been there. I've seen it. I found it very moving.
They refused to put his name on it,
Hobie said. Why?
They never explained. We asked and we begged, but they never told us exactly why. They just said he's no longer considered a casualty.
So we asked them what he is considered as,
Mrs. Hobie said.
They just told us missing in action.
But the other MIAs are on the wall,
Hobie said. There was silence again. The clock hammered away in another room. What did General Garber say about this? Reacher asked.
He didn't understand it,
Hobie said.
Didn't understand it at all. He was still checking for us when he died.
There was silence again. The oxygen hissed and the clock hammered.
But we know what happened, Mrs. Hobie said.
You do? Reacher asked her. What?
The only thing that fits,
she said.
He was taken prisoner.
And never released, Hobie said.
That's why the army is covering it up,
Mrs. Hobie said.
The government is embarrassed about it. The truth is some of our boys were never released. The Vietnamese held on to them like hostages to get foreign aid and trade recognition and credits from us after the war, like blackmail. The government held out for years, despite our boys still being prisoners over there. So they can't admit it. They hide it instead and won't talk about it.
But we can prove it now, Hobie said.
He slid another photograph from the folder, passed it across. It was a newer print, vivid, glossy colors. It was a telephoto shot taken through tropical vegetation. There was barbed wire on bamboo fence posts. There was an oriental figure in a brown uniform,
with a bandana around his forehead, a rifle in his hands. It was clearly a Soviet AK-47, no doubt about it. And there was another figure in the picture, a tall Caucasian looking about 50, emaciated, gaunt, bent, gray, wearing pale, rotted fatigues, looking half away from the Oriental soldier, flinching.
"That's Victor," Mrs. Hobie said. "That's our son. That photograph was taken last year."
"We spent 30 years asking about him," Hobie said. "Nobody would help us. We asked everybody. Then we found a man who told us about these secret camps. There aren't many, just a few with a handful of prisoners. Most of them have died by now. They've grown old and died or been starved to death. This man went to Vietnam and checked for us. He got close enough to take this picture. He even spoke to one of the other prisoners through the wire, secretly at night. It was very dangerous for him. He asked for the name of the prisoner he'd just photographed. It was Vic Hobie, 1st Cavalry Helicopter Pilot."
"The man had no money for a rescue," Mrs. Hobie said. "And we'd already paid him everything we had for the first trip. We had no more left. So when we met General Garber at the hospital, we told him our story and asked him to try and get the government to pay."
Reacher stared at the photograph, stared at the gaunt man with the gray face. "Who else has seen this picture?"
"Only General Garber," Mrs. Hobie answered. "The man who took it told us to keep it a secret, because it's very sensitive politically, very dangerous. It's a terrible thing, buried in the nation's history. But we had to show it to General Garber because he was in a position to help us."
"So what do you want me to do?" Reacher asked. The oxygen hissed in the silence, in and out through the clear plastic tubes. The old man's mouth was working.
"I just want him back," he said. "I just want to see him again one more day before I die."
After that, the old couple were done talking. They turned together and fixed misty gazes on the row of photographs on the mantel. Reacher was left sitting in the silence. Then the old man turned back and used both hands and lifted the leather-bound folder off his bony knees and held it out. Reacher leaned forward and took it. At first, he assumed it was so he could put the three photographs back inside. Then he realized the baton had been passed to him, like a ceremony. Their quest had become Leon's, and now it was his. The folder was thin. Apart from the three photographs he had seen, it contained nothing more than infrequent letters home from their son and formal letters from the Department of the Army, and a sheaf of paperwork showing the liquidation of their life savings and the transfer by certified check of $18,000 to an address in the Bronx to fund a reconnaissance mission to Vietnam led by a man named Rudder. The letters from the boy started with brief notes from various locations in the South as he passed through Dix and Polk and Walters and Rucker and Belvoir and Benning on his way through his training. Then there was a short note from Mobile in Alabama as he boarded ship for the month-long voyage through the Panama Canal and across the Pacific to Indochina. Then there were flimsy army mailgrams from Vietnam itself, 8 from the first tour, 6 from the second. The paper was 30 years old, and it was stiff and dry, like ancient papyrus, like something discovered by archaeologists. He hadn't been much of a correspondent. The letters were full of the usual banal phrases a young soldier writes home. There must have been 100 million parents in the world who treasured old letters like these. Different times, different wars, different languages, but the same messages. The food, the weather, the rumor of action, the reassurances. The responses from the Department of the Army marched through 30 years of office technology. They started out typed on old manual machines, some letters misaligned, some wrongly spaced, some with red halos above them where the ribbon had slipped. Then electric typewriters, crisper and more uniform. Then word processors, immaculately printed on better paper. But the messages were all the same. No information. Missing in action, presumed killed. Condolences. No further information. The deal with the guy called Rudder had left them penniless. There had been some modest mutual funds and a little cash on deposit. There was a sheet written in a shaky hand Reacher guessed was the old woman's, totaling their monthly needs, working the figures again and again, paring them down until they matched the Social Security checks, freeing up their capital. The mutuals had been cashed in 18 months ago, and amalgamated with the cash holdings, and the whole lot had been mailed to the Bronx. There was a receipt from Rudder with the amount formally set off against the cost of the exploratory trip due to leave imminently. There was a request for any and all information likely to prove helpful, including service number and history and any existing photographs. There was a letter dated 3 months subsequently detailing the discovery of the remote camp, the risky clandestine photography, the whispered talk through the wire. There was a prospectus for a rescue mission, planned in great detail, at a projected cost to the Hobies of $45,000. $45,000 they didn't have.
"Will you help us?" the old woman asked through the silence. "Is it all clear? Is there anything you need to know?"
He glanced across her and saw she had been following his progress through the dossier. He closed the folder and stared down at its worn leather cover. Right then, the only thing he needed to know was, why the hell hadn't Leon told these people the truth? Chapter 9. Marilyn Stone missed lunch because she was busy, but didn't mind because she was happy about the way the place was starting to look. She found herself regarding the whole business in a very dispassionate manner, which surprised her a little, because after all, it was her home she was getting ready to sell. Her own home. The place she'd chosen with care and thought and excitement not so many years ago. It had been the place of her dreams. Way bigger and better than anything she'd ever expected to have. It had been a physical thrill back then just thinking about it. Moving in felt like she'd died and gone to heaven. Now she was just looking at the place like a showpiece. Like a marketing proposition. She wasn't seeing rooms she'd decorated and lived in and thrilled to and enjoyed. There was no pain. No wistful glances at places where she and Chester had fooled around and laughed and ate and slept. Just a brisk and businesslike determination to bring it all up to a whole new peak of irresistibility. The furniture movers had arrived first, just as she'd planned. She had them take the credenza out of the hallway and then Chester's armchair out of the living room. Not because it was a bad piece, but because it was definitely an extra piece. It was his favorite chair. Chosen in the way men choose things, for comfort and familiarity rather than for style and suitability. It was the only piece they'd brought from their last house. He'd put it next to the fireplace at an angle. Day to day, she rather liked it. It gave the room a comfortable, lived-in quality. It was the touch that changed the room from a magazine showpiece to a family home, which was exactly why it had to go. She had the movers carry out the butcher's block table from the kitchen, too. She had thought long and hard about that table. It certainly gave the kitchen a no-nonsense look, like it was a proper workplace, speaking of serious meals planned and executed there. But without it, there was an uninterrupted 30-foot expanse of tiled floor running all the way to the bay window. She knew that with fresh polish on the tile, the light from the window would flood the whole 30-foot span into a sea of space. She had put herself in a prospective buyer's shoes and asked herself, which would impress you more, a serious kitchen or a drop-dead spacious kitchen? So the butcher's block was in the mover's truck. The TV from the den was in there, too. Chester had a problem with television sets. Video had killed the home movie side of his business, and he had no enthusiasm for buying the latest and best of his competitors' products. So the TV was an obsolete RCA, not even a console model. It had shiny fake chrome around the screen, and it bulged out like a gray fishbowl. She had seen better sets junked on the sidewalk, looking down from the train when it eased into the 125th Street station. So she'd had the movers clear it out of the den and bring the bookcase down from the guest suite to fill its space. She thought the room looked much better for it. With just the bookcase and the leather couches and the dark lampshades, it looked like a cultured room, an intelligent room. It made it an aspirational space. Like a buyer would be buying a lifestyle, not just a house. She spent some time choosing books for the coffee tables. Then the florist arrived with the flat cardboard boxes full of blooms. She had the girl wash all her vases and then left her alone with a European magazine and told her to copy the arrangements. The guy from Cheryl's office brought the for sale sign, and she had him plant it in the shoulder next to the mailbox. Then the garden crew arrived at the same time the movers were leaving, which required some awkward maneuvering out on the driveway. She led the crew chief around the garden, explaining what had to be done, and then she ducked back inside the house before the roar of the mowers started up. The pool boy came to the door at the same time as the cleaning service people arrived. She was caught glancing left and right between them, momentarily overcome and unsure of who to start first. But then she nodded firmly and told the cleaners to wait and led the boy around to the pool and showed him what needed doing. Then she ran back to the house feeling hungry, realizing she'd missed her lunch, but glowing with satisfaction at the progress she was making. They both made it down the hallway to see him leave. The old man worked on the oxygen long enough to get himself up out of his chair, and then he wheeled the cylinder slowly ahead of him, partly leaning on it like a cane, partly pushing it like a golf trolley. His wife rustled along in front of him, her skirt brushing both door jambs and both sides of the narrow passageway. Reacher followed behind them, with the leather folder tucked up under his arm. The old lady worked the lock on the door, and the old man stood panting and gripping the handle of the cart. The door opened and sweet, fresh air blew in. "Any of Victor's old friends still around here?" Reacher asked.
"Is that important, Major?"
Reacher shrugged. He had learned a long time ago the best way to prepare people for bad news was by looking very thorough right from the start. People listen better if they thought you'd exhausted every possibility. "I just need to build up some background," he said. They looked mystified, but like they were ready to think about it because he was their last hope. He held their son's life in his hands, literally.
"Ed Steven, I guess, at the hardware store,"
Mr. Hobie said, eventually.
"Thick as thieves with Victor, from kindergarten right through 12th grade. But that was 35 years ago, Major. Don't see how it can matter now."
Reacher nodded, because it didn't matter now. "I've got your number," he said. "I'll call you soon as I know anything."
"We're relying on you,"
the old lady said. Reacher nodded again. "It was a pleasure to meet you both," he said. "Thank you for the coffee and the cake, and I'm very sorry about your situation." They made no reply. It was a hopeless thing to say. 30 years of agony, and he was sorry about their situation? He just turned and shook their frail hands and stepped back outside onto their overgrown path. Picked his way back to the Taurus, carrying the folder, looking firmly ahead. He reversed down the driveway, catching the vegetation on both sides, and eased out of the track. Made the right and headed south on the quiet road he'd left to find the house. The town of Brighton firmed up ahead of him. The road widened and smoothed out. There was a gas station and a firehouse. A small municipal park with a Little League diamond. A supermarket with a large parking lot, a bank, a row of small stores sharing a common frontage set back from the street. The supermarket's parking lot seemed to be the geographic center of the town. He cruised slowly past it and saw a nursery with lines of shrubs and pots under a sprinkler which was making rainbows in the sun. Then a large shed, dull red paint, standing in its own lot. Stevens Hardware. He swung the Taurus in and parked next to a timber store in back. The entrance was an insignificant door set in the end wall of the shed. It gave onto a maze of aisles packed tight with every kind of thing he'd never had to buy. Screws, nails, bolts, hand tools, power tools, garbage cans, mailboxes, panes of glass, window units, doors, cans of paint. The maze led to a central core, where four shop counters were set in a square under bright fluorescent lighting. Inside the corral were a man and two boys, dressed in jeans and shirts and red canvas aprons. The man was lean and small, maybe 50, and the boys were clearly his sons, younger versions of the same face and physique, maybe 18 and 20. "Ed Steven?" Reacher asked. The man nodded and set his head at an angle, and raised his eyebrows like a guy who has spent 30 years dealing with inquiries from salesmen and customers. "Can I talk to you about Victor Hobie?" The guy looked blank for a second, and then he glanced sideways at his boys like he was spooling backward all the way through their lives and far beyond, back to when he last knew Victor Hobie. "He died in Nam, right?" he said. "I need some background. Checking for his folks again?" He said it without surprise, and there was an edge of weariness in there, too. Like the Hobie's problems were well known in the town and gladly tolerated, but no longer exciting any kind of urgent sympathy. Reacher nodded. "I need to get a feel for what sort of a guy he was. Story is, you knew him pretty well?" Stephen looked blank again. "Well, I did, I guess. But we were just kids. I only saw him once after high school." "Want to tell me about him?" "I'm pretty busy. I've got unloading to see to. I could give you a hand. We could talk while we're doing it." Stephen started to say a routine no, but then he glanced at Reacher, saw the size of him, and smiled like a laborer who's been offered the free use of a forklift. "Okay," he said. "I'll back." He came out from the corral of counters and led Reacher through a rear door. There was a dusty pickup parked in the sun next to an open shed with a tin roof. The pickup was loaded with bags of cement. The shelves in the open shed were empty. Reacher took his jacket off and laid it on the hood of the truck. The bags were made of thick paper. He knew from his time with the pool gang that if he used two hands on the middle of the bags, they would fold themselves over and split. The way to do it was to clamp a palm on the corner and lift them one-handed. That would keep the dust off his new shirt, too. The bags weighed 100 pounds, so he did them two at a time, one in each hand, holding them out, counterbalanced away from his body. Stephen watched him, like he was a sideshow at the circus. "So tell me about Victor Hobie," Reacher grunted. Stephen shrugged. He was leaning on a post under the tin roof, out of the sun. "Long time ago," he said. "What can I tell you? We were just kids, you know. Our dads were in the Chamber of Commerce together. His was a printer. Mine ran this place. Although it was just a lumber yard back then. We were together all the way through school. We started kindergarten on the same day, graduated high school on the same day. I only saw him once after that, when he was home from the army. He'd been in Vietnam a year, and he was going back again." "So what sort of a guy was he?" Stephen shrugged again. "I'm kind of wary about giving you an opinion." "Why? Some kind of bad news in there?" "No, no, nothing like that," Stephen said. "There's nothing to hide. He was a good kid, but I'd be giving you one kid's opinion about another kid from 35 years ago, right? Might not be a reliable opinion." Reacher paused with a 100-pound bag in each hand, glanced back at Steve. He was leaning on his post in his red apron, lean and fit. The exact picture of what Reacher assumed was a typical cautious, small-town Yankee businessman. The sort of guy whose judgment might be reasonably solid. He nodded. "Okay, I can see that. I'll take it into account." Stephen nodded back, like the ground rules were clear. "How old are you?" 38, Reacher said. "From around here?" Reacher shook his head. "Not really from around anywhere." "Okay. Couple of things you need to understand," Stephen said. "This is a small suburban town, and Victor and I were born here in 48. We were already 15 years old when Kennedy got shot, and 16 before the Beatles arrived, and 20 when there was all that rioting in Chicago and L.A. You know what I'm saying here?" "Different world," Reacher said. "You bet your ass it was," Stephen said back. "We grew up in a different world, our whole childhood. To us, a real daring guy was one who put baseball cards in the wheels of his Schwinn. You need to bear that in mind when you hear what I say." Reacher nodded, lifted the 9th and 10th bag out of the pickup bed. He was sweating lightly and worrying about the state of his shirt when Jody next saw it. "Victor was a very straight kid," Stephen said. "A very straight and normal kid. And like I say, for comparative purposes, that was back when the rest of us thought we were the bee's knees for staying out until 9:30 on a Saturday night drinking milkshakes." "What was he interested in?" Reacher asked. Stephen blew out his cheeks and shrugged. "What can I tell you? Same thing as all the rest of us, I guess.
Baseball, Mickey Mantle. We liked Elvis, too. Ice cream and the Lone Ranger, stuff like that, normal stuff.
His dad said he always wanted to be a soldier.
We all did. First it was cowboys and Indians, then it was soldiers.
So did you go to Nam?